test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You will hear a telephone conversation between an operator and a caller. The caller is reporting a stolen mobile phone. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 5.
Good morning, Z Mobile Services. This is Tess speaking. How can I help?
I want to report a stolen mobile phone.
Could you confirm your postcode, please, sir?
It's CN21EB.
Thanks. And your house number?
34.
Okay. Can you give me the telephone number of the phone that was stolen?
Yeah, it's... Wait a minute. It's 07890.
07890.
623.
623.
570.
570. Okay. So it's 07890. 623-570.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you just confirm your name?
Yeah, it's Thomas Green.
Is that Thomas spelt T-H-O-M-A-S?
No, there's no H. It's just Thomas. T-O-M-A-S.
Okay, so you said your phone was stolen.
That's right. I reported it to the police this morning.
That's good. I'll need to take down your crime reference number.
I've got it here. It's CZ.
CZ.
Dash 17624.
17624.
Dash 5.
5. Thank you. Let me run through that again. CZ dash 17624 dash 5.
That's it.
Just a few more details. Can I have your IMEI number?
Oh, what's that?
It's the International Mobile Equipment Identity Number. It's a...
Sorry, I don't have it.
Not to worry. We'll deal with that in a moment. I just need to have the date and time your mobile was stolen.
That's easy. Between 1 and 2 o'clock yesterday.
That's 1 to 2pm on the 16th of August. Thank you.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 6 to 10.
Now, I just need a few details of the incident, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I was in the Bang's coffee bar in the city centre. I definitely had my phone with me when I sat down. In fact, I remember checking to see if I had any text messages. But when I came to leave, it wasn't on the table.
Did you leave the phone unattended at any time, perhaps to go to the toilet?
No. That's the funny thing. Like I told the police, it was very busy in there because it was lunchtime and all the tables and chairs were pushed really close together. There were a couple of other people at my table. Someone must have leaned across when I wasn't looking and slipped my phone into their pocket.
Oh dear.
Oh no, it's such a pain. I suppose I'll have to pay for a replacement.
Fortunately, you're covered by our 12-month care plan, so there won't be a charge for replacing it this time. But I have to tell you, if it happens again within the next 3 months, you may have to pay a fee.
Fair enough. How soon can you send me a new one?
We've got two options. You can get it sent by courier for next day delivery for a small fee, or we can send it in the standard post free of charge. You should allow about 5 days for it to arrive.
That's a bit difficult. I'm going back to Australia the day after tomorrow to see my parents for a month. Any chance you could send it to their address?
No, I'm sorry. We can only send replacements to UK addresses.
In that case, I'd better have next day delivery then.
Okay, so just to confirm the delivery address, is it 34 Solent Gardens?
That's it.
The final thing we need to do is to put a block on your phone.
You mean to stop the thief from using it? I was wondering about that.
What I need to do is put your IMEI number into the central register, which will essentially prevent anyone else from making calls from your phone. Now, the IMEI number is a 15-digit number that you can see underneath the phone's battery. Do you have a record of it?
No, sorry. Is there any other way to find the number?
Yes. We usually trace it from a call you've recently made. In a moment, I'll put you through to my colleague who deals with that. By the time you've finished with him, your mobile will no longer operate.
Good.
And with your new phone, I'll also send you a crime prevention leaflet, which will give you some tips on how to protect your phone from being stolen again.
Thanks. You've been really helpful.
Don't mention it. Just putting you through to my colleague now.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You are going to hear an interview with a student advisor on a podcast. The advisor is giving financial advice for overseas students going to the UK to study at university. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen and answer questions 11 to 15.
Welcome to our monthly podcast for overseas students planning to study in the UK. This month we're looking at how to make your money last longer while studying here. And to help us find some bargains, I have Jenny Lubeck from the Student Union. Jenny, students are renowned for being hard up, but there are lots of savings to be made, aren't there?
Well, as soon as students start their course at university or college, they'll be able to buy their NUS Extra card. This will enable them to get a wide range of discounts on essentials like books, clothes and eating out. The card only costs about £12 for 1 year, and for about the same amount you can include an ISIC card. The ISIC is an internationally recognised discount card for full-time students. Discount offerings vary and usually include things like travel, guidebooks, music, eating out, that kind of thing. Students are told all about this when they start their studies, but if your listeners want to find out more about these cards before they arrive, I've put some details of websites on the podcast page.
Now, travel costs can mount up for students, can't they? I know the ISIC card is useful here, but are there any other things students should be aware of?
Understandably, lots of overseas students like to take the opportunity to travel around the country whilst they're in the UK. And, for this reason, I'd strongly recommend they invest in a young person's rail card. To be eligible, you need to be between 16 and 25. Mature students over the age of 25 can also apply, so long as they're in full-time education. You can buy a one-year or three-year card, and it gives you a third off rail journeys across the UK. The card also gives you access to competitions and things like theatre discounts and holiday offers. At the moment, a one-year card costs £28 and it's £65 for a three-year card.
Before you hear more of the interview, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
And what about buses?
Well, as well as the rail card, it's also more than likely the local bus operators will offer discounted bus travel with their own travel cards. These aren't aimed specifically at students, but can still save you a lot of money if you use the buses regularly. You can usually get these cards for a week, a month, a term, or a whole year, with bigger savings the longer the period. Another advantage of these cards is that, as well as making it cheaper to commute to and from university, you'll also find them very handy free transport whenever you need to do some shopping or visit friends in your area.
Are there any cultural things that students coming to the UK might not be aware of that can save them money?
Some overseas students are surprised by the amount of recycling that goes on in the UK and how much money can be saved in the process. There'll be a roaring trade in used course books in the student union on campus. Lots of students who were on the same course as you the year before will be selling their books at the end of their course. They'll be a lot cheaper than buying them new. Off campus, you'll find lots of charity shops in your local town centre, with a good selection of novels, and you'll often get some really nice clothes, CDs and DVDs that people have donated, and all at very cheap prices. Of course, shopping in this way means you're contributing to a worthwhile cause as well. And check your local paper frequently for car boot sales. Car boot sales are a very British style of market, where private individuals come together to sell home and garden goods. In fact, they're a great way of recycling some of your own unwanted stuff and can help you make some money in the process. Finally, there are websites and mailing lists where local people offer up items they no longer want for free, as long as you agree to collect them.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear two students talking about revising for exams. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 23. Now listen and answer questions 21 to 23.
Elaine, have you seen the exam timetable? They've just put it up on the department notice board.
Yeah, I've just come from there. I must be honest, I'd put the thought of exams to the back of my mind. Now the dates are there, it all seems a little scary. Have you been revising much?
No, not really. We've got a month, so I'm going to really get going on it now. Why don't we try and work together?
Yes, let's meet a few times a week. I don't like working on my own. I never seem to be able to focus properly. What about Tuesday and Thursday? Oh, no, I have a late seminar on Tuesday. Monday and Thursday? What about that?
Yes, that'll be okay. How do you go about revising? Have you got any tips?
Well, our tutor said we shouldn't start background reading or writing notes until we're clear in our mind what we need to revise. He said start with a revision timetable so we know what to revise and when.
That sounds sensible. Then we can use the timetable to work independently. It'll help us to make sure we're both working on the same subjects. We can make that the first thing to do in our first session. Write up a timetable.
Okay. I reckon the kinds of things we can do on our own in between meetings are things like arranging our materials, lecture and seminar notes, handouts, feedback from our tutors, that kind of thing. If we arrange all these by subject, according to the timetable, it'll help us get organised.
Before you hear more of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 24 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 24 to 30.
Good idea. Once we have all the content, I suppose we could make notes based on past exam papers. We had a talk about note-taking in one of the seminars. They reckon you shouldn't copy word for word. It helps to learn things if you paraphrase main points. And don't just copy loads of facts either. Try to get a feel for the main arguments or theories and match any facts to these.
I also like using mind maps or spidergrams when I make notes. It means you can put down a lot of information, but so that it's nicely organised. It also means you can add new notes after, and bullet points. They really help you focus on main points rather than trying to link them together in sentences.
We also need to remember to make a note of where the information comes from. The author, publisher, that kind of thing.
That's really important. Otherwise, when you're writing the assignment, you can never remember where you got a particular quote from.
I know I said earlier about testing each other when we get together, but now I think about it, do you think it'd be a better idea to talk through our notes on a particular subject, have a kind of discussion between ourselves? We could use the questions in the past papers to base the discussion on.
Yes, so basically the timetable can be a discussion schedule. Then after each session, we could go away and do a timed essay on the subject. Maybe swap and mark each other's essays. That's a good way to learn, I think. Critique each other's work.
Great idea. So we'll start next Monday with the timetable.
That is the end of part 3.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part 4.
Part 4.
You will hear a lecture on immigration patterns.
First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
This morning, I'd like to focus on New York as a model for understanding immigration patterns in relation to national rather than international change. Firstly, it is important to understand that migration patterns are primarily affected by the rules of immigration, which determine the conditions of entry. After that, internal changes can affect patterns considerably. To highlight my first point, let's study this diagram of Ellis Island and the process of admitting immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Upon arrival at Ellis Island, people underwent a series of examinations and questions before being allowed to enter the US. First of all, there was a medical inspection to ensure the immigrants were not bringing in any contagious diseases. Anyone who did not pass the medical examination was refused entry to New York and sent home on the next available ship. If the examination was passed, immigrants were required to take a further examination, this time a legal examination to establish whether they had any criminal convictions. After this, immigrants were able to change currency and purchase tickets for onward rail travel from New York. Having completed this simple process, immigrants were told to wait. This wait could be as long as 5 hours before boarding a ferry to take them to New York City. This simple system allowed millions of immigrants to enter the US and is largely responsible for the ethnic makeup of the city today. Even though the immigrants themselves may have had a variety of reasons for deciding to migrate, it was only possible because of US national immigration laws. Moving on to the second point, how changes within a country can have as much or more of an effect than those outside the country, various parts of New York have changed radically in their ethnic makeup over the last 200 years. Communities became wealthier, governments introduced new laws, and employment opportunities came and went. These factors affect where people choose to live or force them to move to somewhere different. For example, most people think that the population has changed in Manhattan due to the rise of its importance as a financial trade center, which is true to some extent. But like the Ellis Island example, a change in politics, namely a change of mayor, allowed the city to boom as a financial center, and this resulted in different types of people moving to the area. Brooklyn is an interesting example too, and we'll be looking at it as our case study later in the lecture. Whereas it used to be a predominantly working-class area of the city and therefore attracted unskilled migrant workers, nowadays its fame as a centre for up-and-coming artists and musicians means it has attracted a new and much more diverse population of middle-class residents. Finally, Queens has shown a dramatic change in its population over the last 50 years due to the airports there. This means that the number of airline staff living in the area has dramatically increased and changed the nature of the local population. Finally, I'd like to use Brooklyn as a case study of local change. Brooklyn's population has changed significantly over the years, and this can most easily be seen in its economic activity. Tracing the Brooklyn industries back from the current financial services companies to manufacturing in the 1950s to shipbuilding in the 1900s, we can map this onto average wages and therefore the type and class of resident. And this has affected the population density too, which has been steadily increasing over the past 100 years from 1.5 million in 1900 through to 2 million in the middle of the 20th century to the 2.3 million inhabitants today. In fact, Brooklyn is suffering from considerable overpopulation now. But this large population increase was due not to employment, but the building of the subway, which linked Brooklyn to other areas of New York. Prior to this, at the beginning of the 20th century, the only way of transportation was the Brooklyn Bridge. Another factor which traditionally increases the desire for the middle classes to live in a particular place is the extent and type of local heritage, especially for those people with young children. In Brooklyn, this is evident in the increase in population after the construction of Coney Island. The modern-day equivalent of this is the restoration of Prospect Park, which has brought more middle-income families into the area. That is the end of the listening test. In the exam, you will have half a minute to check your